This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Friday, so let's dive right into our week in review, starting with questions around the multi-billion dollar fantasy sports industry, including, is it a game of skill or chance? And is it even legal? Here's Jason Robbins, the CEO of one of the largest sites, DraftKings, based right here in Boston. He says daily fantasy sports betting is not gambling.
We're not the house. We're just facilitating games between other people. Much like a chess competition. If you're a better chess player, you're gonna win most of the time.
Attorney General Maura Healey says the state's laws aren't clear on the question, and the Massachusetts Gaming Commission is looking into it. Here's Chairman Stephen Crosby.
Frankly, I don't think the real question is whether under today's law, fantasy sports are legal technically or not. I think the real question is, does the Commonwealth of Massachusetts want fantasy sports to be legal?
To consider that question and others from this week in the news, we're joined by Dante Ramos. He's the op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe. And Dante, good to have you.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Arlene Isaacson. She's a political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. And Arlene, great to have you back as well.
Thank you.
So, Dante, I'll start with you because you wrote about this today in the Boston Globe. What do you think? What do you make of this sort of uncertain times and fantasy sports and where we are?
It's a fascinating story because there is a legal gray area here. If you were going to bet on one player or the outcome of one game, that's something that would be considered illegal under federal gambling law. But if you aggregate those things together on a fantasy team, it's a little bit more nebulous.
More nebulous because there's some skill involved.
Because ostensibly there's some skill involved. I mean, presumably there's also some skill in knowing whether the Patriots are going to win by 7 or 10. But for whatever reason, it seems like a somewhat arbitrary distinction that's baked into the law. And DraftKings is a company that has basically grown up around that somewhat arbitrary distinction. And so, their interpretation of the law that they're legal is not completely uncontested. Regulators in Nevada seem to think otherwise, and it's something that I think a lot of the elected leaders in our state are trying to be tolerant of innovation or frankly seem to be happy to hang back and let the thing develop a little bit before they come up with any definitive outcome.
Right. And Arlene, let me turn to you. I guess there are a couple of questions here. I mean, the idea, is it gambling? Is it a game of chance? Should it be legal? Take a crack at any one of those questions.
Well, I suppose I should confess first that I didn't really understand anything about daily fantasy sports sites at all. Now, call me a bad lesbian, but I just don't get it. Why do people care about it? Why do they do it? Why do they find it interesting? So I've been on the phone with friends recently, having them explain to me again and again why it is that it matters. And when this whole debate came up recently, I couldn't help but find it fascinating how many people were deeply involved and invested in the notion of, does it require skill or not, as a determination for is it gambling? Now, it seems to me that's almost irrelevant, because why does it matter if skill is involved? Well, it may matter legally, of course. But other than that, if you play blackjack and you're able to do card counting, you're still gambling, though that's a great skill.
Yeah.
If you go and bet on the horses, you may know something about horses, and that will help make it more likely that you can win, but it is still gambling. So there's the legal definition of gambling, and there is the common sense one. And I tend to weigh in on the common sense one, which is, if it walks like a duck, and it talks like a duck, and it looks like a duck, 10 to 1 it's a duck.
Well, it's interesting. We had Dan Okrent on the show earlier this week, and so he's the father of fantasy sports. He didn't realize quite what he invented back in 1980 when he started Rotisserie Baseball with a few pals. By the way, former public editor of the New York Times. And he just said, no question, this is gambling. I mean, he doesn't even. So on the other hand, here's sports attorney Daniel Wallach talking to WBUR. And he argues that there's skill involved in fantasy sports betting, and that's what makes it legal here.
So in those states like Massachusetts, which follow the predominant purpose test, daily fantasy sports is almost inarguably purely legal and would not be subject to any challenges. But in the rest of the country, we have a fair degree of murkiness, an unsettled law.
So Dante, where does this go? I mean, Maura Healey is looking into this. The state attorney general, Beacon Hill lawmakers are considering it. We heard from Stephen Crosby, chairman of the State Gaming Commission. A lot of people are sort of churning and looking and thinking. And where does this take us?
By the way, I want to just point out a telling phrase in that clip, almost inarguably purely legal. Well, that settles everything. I think, you know, what... There doesn't seem
to
be much,
lawyer or something.
There doesn't seem to be much of an organized push here to ban it outright. Mm. What you do hear people saying, and it sounds like a legitimate impulse to me, is to say, let us regulate it for the purposes of consumer protection. There really are legitimate questions about, you know, if not DraftKings, then some other sites that might pop up that, you know, is this a legitimate place to enter your $20 or does it disappear into, you know, is it some kind of scam website? Similarly, are there methods in place to protect against problem gambling? That's something that is going to exist at the casinos when they are built, supposedly. You know, these methods to keep people from gambling away their savings. So, like, you know, is DraftKings or its imitators, will they have similar things built in? And I think that's the type of regulation you're going to be seeing.
Yeah. What do you think, Arlene? Does that sound right? I mean, if there are going to be regulations, does that sound right to you?
Well, it is sad to think we'll have yet one more venue in which we can exacerbate compulsive gambling problems, but that horse is probably out of the barn. If they are acting in any fashion like casinos, even mini or micro versions of casinos, then there should be some version of oversight, minimally for consumer protection purposes.
All right. Well, let's turn now to presidential politics, the race for the Democratic nomination, and a new WBUR poll of likely Democratic voters in New Hampshire. It finds that Democrat Hillary Clinton has moved ahead of Bernie Sanders, who calls himself a Democratic socialist, by 4 points. And perhaps the most interesting part of the poll, which we talked about yesterday on Radio Boston, roughly half of the respondents said that a socialist president would be acceptable. That number jumped to over 60% when respondents were asked about a Democratic socialist president. Now, we spent some time yesterday talking about exactly what that would mean. But we also talked about why there's so many voters who suddenly are comfortable with the idea of socialism or democratic socialism. And Arlene, what do you think this is? And did that poll, that part of the poll, surprise you in any way?
I was shocked by it, but I was actually very pleased. I actually think that democratic socialism as a term is having its moment, quote unquote, that we're finally moving away from the knee-jerk fear of the S word, socialism, that had existed for decades before this, which is great. It moves us to a discussion of issues and ideas instead of just the labels. Because after all, Social Security and Medicare are arguably very much democratic socialist models of government, and yet they're things that even conservatives support.
Yeah. On the other hand, Dante, speaking of labels, when we get into the general election, I think the S word, we'll call it, might still be a kind of potent label for opponents to use.
I think that's right. There is a whole generation of people who are coming up after the fall of the Soviet Union who probably don't have the same negative associations.
Right.
On the other hand, there's still a lot of voters out there. You know, older people tend to vote in droves and remember the Soviet Union quite well. So if I were the eventual Democratic nominee, whether it's Sanders or Hillary Clinton, I wouldn't want to spend a lot of time during the campaign talking about democratic socialism as opposed to some of the underlying issues that Arlene mentioned.
It's interesting. The poll also found, and Arlene, you just made reference to this, that younger respondents were more likely to hold a positive view of socialism. And we spoke to Tim McCarthy yesterday. He's the program director for the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard, a self-proclaimed democratic socialist. And here's his explanation for this trend that he gave us.
Their identity as a generation has been forged in the Great Recession and in the stagnant recovery, and they're feeling vulnerable. They're feeling insecure. They're feeling like their prospects for opportunity, which have so often been part of that, you know, great myth of America, of upward mobility, are eclipsed.
So there it is, the idea that as this younger generation comes of age, it's less of a problem. Does that's sort of what you were saying, Arlene, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't for a moment think that Bernie has a chance of winning, but his involvement in the race, I think, is very important. And his use of the term democratic socialism, I think, is important. And it's all of both combined are moving us to a more realistic place where there's more of a critical analysis of the economic drivers that cause such income disparities that we're seeing now. So for Bernie and for the democratic socialist term, I say what Teddy Roosevelt said, bully for them.
Well, let's move on to another development in the race for the White House. This morning, former Rhode Island governor and Senator Lincoln Chafee announced he was ending his campaign for the Democratic nomination. Here's what he said.
Now, as you may know, I've been campaigning on a platform of prosperity through peace. But after much thought, I've decided to end my campaign for the president today. Thank you. But I would like to take this opportunity one last time to advocate for a chance be given to peace.
All right. Former Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee there announcing that he's no longer a candidate for the Democratic nomination to become president. He then proceeded to talk about the ancient Greek comedy Lysistrata, which, Dante, I think has to be the first in the history of the presidential nominating contest that something like that has happened.
I think his discussion of Lysistrata guarantees that the asterisk percentage of voters who were supporting his campaign will become the swing vote in this. Chafee had his moment at the debate. He got on a national stage, had an opportunity to set forth some of his ideas. I don't think the reviews of that appearance were necessarily positive, but it makes a lot of sense for him to get out of the race. What he was doing it in the first place is what mystifies a lot of people.
Yeah, were you mystified, Arlene?
Well, I will confess something I've never told folks, which is that I have frequently referenced Lysistrata as a political technique to win some of the issues that I've worked on in the legislature over the years. And Chafee leaving the race is really going to disappoint SNL, Saturday Night Live, and a variety of other follows. But he's a good egg, and I'm glad that he gave it a try.
Sure. So Chafee out, Jim Webb out, Biden not in. So there's the race. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and former Maryland Governor
Martin O'Malley.
Martin O'Malley. Thank you, Dante. Suddenly my brain went empty there. So let's move on to another big story this week. It's about the state's biotech industry. Cambridge-based Biogen, the largest biotech company in Massachusetts, announced that it plans to cut 11% of its worldwide workforce. That's almost 900 workers, including some 400 right here in Massachusetts. So here's Biogen CEO George Skankos. He says the move will allow the company to invest in other programs.
Although this action is extremely difficult, it's a necessary step in order for us to fulfill our goals as a company.
So, Dante, is this a sign of trouble in the Massachusetts biotech world?
It's not a great development, obviously. There's been speculation for some time that the rate of new investment money coming into biotech is not sustainable and that there's bound to be a pullback. That certainly seems reasonable. The environment in which drugs are developed is extremely risky. One of the things that came up in the coverage of Biogen is that they had a single multiple sclerosis drug that was supposed to bring in $6 to $7 billion a year at its peak. And then there was this discovery of a potential rare side effect of the drug that would mean that it would only bring in $5 billion. That still seems like a ton of money. Mm-hmm. But if you are a company developing, a large suite of different types of drugs, and that the successful ones have to, subsidize the unsuccessful research, then you start to get a picture of the risk that's involved and the odds against almost anything coming out. And so, eventually, yes, of course, there's bound to be a coming back to earth of the biotech industry.
Right. And Arlene, on the other hand, the state's been doing really well in biotech by some measures. A third of all U.S. biotech seed money comes to Massachusetts. And since 2008, research and development jobs here have grown more than 20%. But maybe, as I think Dante was suggesting there, that sort of upward line can't remain heading upward indefinitely.
No, that's very true. I mean, for the 400 people in the Cambridge area who are going to lose their jobs, it's clearly devastating mm-hmm. news. On the other side of the ledger, though, we're talking about a company that had a profit margin last year of over $3 billion, with a B, $3 billion. So don't cry for me, Argentina. I'm not feeling bad for Biogen at all, but I feel very bad for the workers who are being laid off. I mean, Dante's right. There's an inevitable There are so many new pharma companies now, it's inevitable that some will fail. And part of the challenge in this business world is the expectation that has existed for too long now that the drug makers can pretty much charge whatever they want. And that's increasingly being challenged. We saw the New York pharma company, the rather obnoxious CEO, Martin Shkreli, who made an announcement to create a great scandal a month ago by saying that a pill that had previously sold for $13 would now be sold not for $13, but for $750.
You know, I'm glad you brought this point up, and we actually talked about it with one of Dante's colleagues, Boston Globe reporter Robert Weissman, and he told us there's a bit of a backlash against the high cost of drugs, and it could be having an effect on the biotech sector. Here's what he said.
George Scangos, the Biogen CEO, he basically said some of what you're hearing is political rhetoric, but he also said the industry needs to do a better job in explaining the justification for these drug prices. You know, critics of the industry will still say that these drugs are driving up the price of the healthcare system and it's unsustainable.
So, Dante, what do you think? What about the problem of runaway drug prices and what needs to be done about that?
There does seem to be a certain arbitrariness about what prices get charged for things. It's a function, I would say more broadly, of the sort of lack of price sensitivity in a way in the healthcare system as a whole. There's a lot of discussion about how, you know, with third-party payers paying on behalf of patients, paying hospitals and drug companies and things like that, nobody really has a good sense of what anything costs. And people end up setting prices that really don't seem to have much of a relationship to anything other than somebody's best guess about what the market can bear. What's tricky about it, I think, you know, again, that's something that hopefully healthcare reform will bring under control. It's also something that you hope that if there's less money that's going into drug companies because of, a more rational pricing strategy, that will end up, research on life-saving drugs will still be funded, and that some other less necessary things, administrative overhead, things like that, are the parts that are going to get cut.
Mm. Well, I want to leave time to talk about the push for criminal justice reform that we heard about this week. More than 130 police chiefs, sheriffs, and attorneys from across the country, many of them from Massachusetts and New England, have formed a group called Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration. Some of them met with President Obama this week. They point out there are more people in U.S. prisons than the combined populations of Vermont, Delaware, and Wyoming. And they say incarceration turns people's lives upside down, hurts the communities they belong to, and costs taxpayers an astonishing $80 billion per year. So here's Middlesex Sheriff Peter Katujan, a member of the group that met with President Obama yesterday.
By adjusting those minimum mandatories, right there alone, you'll begin to change the effects of incarceration on individuals and minorities, but not only them, but their families and their communities, which are being ravaged by this overloading of incarceration.
So, Arlene, what do you think of this? This seems to be a sign that pendulum is swinging back from the tough on crime era to the, I don't know, maybe smarter on crime era. It's been doing that for a while, but what do you think?
I think you described it perfectly. The notion that these experts in law enforcement, police chiefs and prosecutors, are now saying that more incarceration does not keep our community safe is hugely significant. The fact that they're saying that good crime control policy is not about locking up everyone, it's about locking up the right people, and that they want to reform mandatory minimum sentence laws is very, very significant.
Interesting. Well, State Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Ralph Gantz said this week that the U.S. is a nation gone mad with mass incarceration. Last year, he called for an end to mandatory minimum sentences. That hasn't happened yet. Dante, do you expect to see, I don't know, real progress on this issue?
I think progress on this issue always ends up being incremental, unfortunately. As a policy matter, I think that the law enforcement leaders who met with the president are absolutely right. What's tricky in backing down from this tough on crime stance is that there will always be a case of someone who was in prison who gets out and commits a bad crime, maybe a worse crime than they committed, to get in there in the first place. And that's something that draws politicians' attention and is very, it's very difficult to persuade people in practice that you know, letting lots of people out of prison is a good idea. And, you know, politicians worry about that.
Fear of the Willie Horton syndrome.
Fear of the Willie Horton system. Absolutely. The one thing I would say looks like a positive, if you look down the list of members of this law enforcement group, there are a lot of former U.S. attorneys and current district attorneys in various parts of the country. And, you know, so much discretion in this area lies with prosecutors' offices in terms of what they decide to charge, who they decide to charge, how hard they decide to, to push the defendants, that if there's real participation from DAs, that's a significant change.
Interesting. Well, speaking of that, yesterday we spoke to a Boston attorney and the former U.S. attorney for the District of Massachusetts, Donald Stern. And he talked about how this was a particular moment politically where something actually might happen in terms of reform. Here's what he said.
There's an interesting coming together of the left and the right on some of these issues. And I think what you're seeing is, maybe for different motivations, the left and the right coming together for what we hope would be a smarter, more effective, but still very safe criminal justice system.
So, Arlene, some optimism there from Donald Stern.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when 50% of the prison population have mental illnesses, and when 65% of the prison population have substance abuse and addiction problems, you know that prison is not where they should be. So the notion that there's a bipartisan effort afoot to end mandatory minimums and reduce the prison population is a very good sign.
All right. Well, we've got enough time left for our hubbubs, those little short stories that might not have made it to the top of the newscast but caught the attention of all of us. So, Dante, let me start with you. What's your hubbub?
The MBTA is spending more than $500 million to buy about 300 new cars for the red, orange, and green lines. An obvious question arises, what are these cars going to look like? This week, the MBTA asked the public to vote on paint schemes for those new cars. In an internet survey that runs until November 3rd, there are three choices for each line. One caveat, the options for the green line actually look a lot alike. So, you know, they didn't really get too far away from the standards, subway car paint job. But it's great that it's a matter that the MBTA could have decided bureaucratically and instead decided to let the public take ownership.
All right. Hear, hear for that. Arlene, how about you? What's your hubbub?
Well, I loved an article that I saw in the Globe by Allison Arnett, where she talked about local farms are extending their growing season by using plastic sheets to create these modern greenhouse structures they call high tunnels. And it's turning New England farms into full-year enterprises, which, to me, with the increased demand for locally sourced food, is a real win-win for farmers, consumers, and the region.
All right. So here's my hubbub. It's a quick update on my colleague Magnus' hubbub from last week. And it's all about Dino, that fugitive cockatoo that was on the loose in Brookline, ravaging the home of our good friend, former federal judge Nancy Gertner. Dino is finally behind bars. According to the Boston Globe, it took 3 months of cages, traps, and a small army of rescue workers to catch the irascible cockatoo who spent the summer terrorizing Judge Gertner's home. But he's back in the cage and back with his owner. Now, we may emailed Judge Gertner to find out what she thought about mandatory minimum sentences for criminal birds. And she said this, which sort of surprised us. In this case, she would have opted for the death penalty. So there we go. Dante Ramos, op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks for coming in. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus and a political consultant. Arlene, great to have you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, our series of congressional conversations continues with Congresswoman Catherine Clark. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.